today, let's go to 1 Peter chapter 4. In 4, 1 through 6, Peter will be talking about the fact that as believers, we are to experience death to the old life. And in 4, 7 through 11, the emphasis will shift to a life for the glory of God. So we can really say, 4, 1 through 6 is negative, what ought not to be in the believer's life. And then 4, 7 through 11 will be positive, or what ought to be in the believer's life. So let's simply caption verses 1 through 6 under the idea, death to the old life. 4, 1 through 6. Now in reading 4, 1 through 6, let me emphasize that as we sit here, perhaps you can look back to your pre-salvation days. And they weren't all that bad, because many, many people who become Christians have already lived fairly decent lives. Keep in mind, as we look at 1 Peter chapter 4, these people had lived absolutely outrageous lives. When you come down to verse 3, the things spoken of here were all public outrage. They were things that were not even acceptable in non-Christian society, and these people had been involved in them. So I think we have to fairly say that the people we're looking at are people who had lived outrageously bad lives in time past, and Peter is setting them against that background and saying that old life is to be all over. And the first thing he does is give a command to a right attitude. And the command to a right attitude is in 4:1. 4:1 says, therefore. And as you would well know, if you've been around at all, you would know that that would be the first word that we're going to park on. Because the word therefore always means, here is what to do or think in the light of what you have just been taught. In other words, it points backwards. Now the question is, what has just been taught? Well, if you were here on Wednesday, what we studied in the preceding verses was a simple fact. He started in verse 17 by saying, it is better, if God should will it so, that you should suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. And his theme will become, more good can come out of suffering for what is right than you would ever dream of. And the prime example, 18 through 22, Christ suffered for what he did not deserve. And what came out of it? The thing that came out of his undeserved suffering was the greatest blessing in the world. And therefore, he's simply emphasizing a point that is needed, and it's needed for all of us, is that there is nothing more difficult than undeserved suffering. Because all of us inherently want to be treated fairly. Probably most of us can say there is no time when you are more outraged, when you have been clearly right and your rights have not been respected. And there's just no kind of suffering that makes us, from the human standpoint, more angry than to be clearly wronged and have to suffer for it. And Peter is arguing this, that there is only one real case of undeserved suffering, and that was Christ. And let me ask you what came out of it. The greatest blessing this world has ever known, the blessing of our salvation. So we ought to at least look at the fact that if we are wronged, though the human response is, I want my rights, I want to be treated fairly, I want to be treated justly, this is not right, I resent it, well, at least stop for just a moment and remember the cross. What did he deserve? And the answer is, he deserved none of it. What did he accomplish? And the accomplishment is the greatest in the world. So there is potential for something coming out of that. So, chapter 4, and he hasn't exhorted us in chapter 3 about this yet. He just gave us the example. And now chapter 4 is going to say, therefore. So he's going to say, the therefore is go back to 3:18. And in 3:18 we read, Christ also died for sins once for all, just for the unjust, in order that he might bring us to God, Therefore, in the light of his attitude toward undeserved suffering, we ought to have the same. So the word therefore is pointing back to willingness to suffer undeservedly. That's been the context. The willingness to suffer undeservably. So chapter 4, verse 1 says, therefore, in the light of his undeserved suffering, since Christ has suffered in the flesh. Notice, by the way, when we were back in the preceding context talking about Christ's sufferings, we noted that his sufferings were of two kinds. Number one, suffering that was simply exemplary. In other words, here's what he did, we ought to do the same. And second, recall, there was the part of his suffering that was substitutionary. And whenever Peter talks about our suffering with the Lord, he's always talking about the exemplary. We cannot suffer as an atonement for sins. We cannot suffer the just on behalf of the unjust. We cannot die for sins. And it's interesting, is it not, that when chapter 3, verse 18 says Christ died for sins, when he repeats that idea in chapter 1, he does not say, therefore, since Christ has suffered for sins, arm yourselves with the same mind, because we cannot experience the substitutionary suffering of Christ. We can experience the undeserved part of his suffering. And 1 Peter 4:1 is not talking about that. So therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same mind. So the command, and now in the command, notice you have obligation. And it's the obligation flowing off of the undeserved suffering of Christ, and it is arm yourselves. And the chief thing to say about the word arm is the word is very, very, very strong. In the Greek military, they had two states of preparation or arming on the part of a soldier, and they had two words for it. They had one for a soldier that had on his full combat gear. He had everything that you could possibly arm a Greek soldier with. Then you had the one who was not armed for combat. And of course, we still have that today, is that there's the light arming, and then there's the arming when the man is ready to go in an actual combat situation. And the word used here is the strong word. It is the word for combat. Combat preparation. That means you've got everything strapped on you. You've got all the armor that is available. So, verse 1, therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves to the hilt with the same purpose. And notice that is mental attitude. And the idea involved would be you have the insight, the determination that he suffered undeservedly, and I'm going to gain the same type of thing. Now, third, you have the basis of this suffering. And the basis is introduced by the word because. It says, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. Now, several things are necessary right here. In the first place, when it says he who has suffered, that's a present tense. It's translated in our Bibles as though it were a past tense. But that's not the case. He is presently suffering. The words in the flesh would refer to physical suffering. So he who is suffering physically has ceased from sin. Now, we want to answer, what does it mean he has ceased from sin? And the answer, I think, can be arrived at by asking a question. Why do you think the person in verse 1 is suffering in the flesh? What's the cause for it? Why is he suffering? Well, the person in verse 1 is suffering in the flesh for a simple reason. He's chosen to walk with the Lord. And because he's chosen to walk with the Lord, he has said no to his sin nature. The next thing to note is, see the word ceased? Perfect tense. Means it's done. It is finished. It is complete. It is over with. Third thing to mention, and this is important, is the word has ceased is not active voice, it's passive voice. What's the difference? Active voice means the subject is producing the action. Passive voice means you have been acted upon. So it is not the idea that somehow this person has produced from their own efforts and said, I will fight sin and I will stop sin. That would be active voice. The action is not flowing from him. He has been acted upon. And therefore, I think the best way to translate that would be simply say, he has gotten release. That gets the idea of the passive voice, doesn't it? He has gotten release. Better yet, now that I think of it, he has received release. You know, something has happened to him. He has received release from, and the word sin has no article. No article means he's talking not about an act of sin, but the thing. So he's referring to the sin nature. He has gotten release from his sin nature. Or we're talking about the Romans 6 concept. So it is not saying that he is sinless. It is saying that he has gotten release from the domination of his sin nature. So, latter clause, because he who is suffering in the flesh has gotten release from his sin nature. How do we know he has gotten release or freedom from his sin nature? Because he's suffering. And he's suffering in this world because he refuses to go the way of the sin nature. He refuses the world standards, and consequently he is going to be suffering in this world, and in that sense he has gotten release from the sense of the domination of his sin nature. Now, what is the purpose of this release? What is the purpose of the release or the purpose of the freedom? That's in verse 2, negatively and positively. First of all, negatively. So as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. So the purpose is, so God's will may become central. We have been freed from the domination of the sin nature, so the central issue will be the will of God, chapter 4 and verse 2. Viewed positively, well, viewed negatively and positively, negatively would be first half of the verse, live the rest of the time in the flesh no longer for the desires of men, but positively for the will of God. Then he gives a reason for the new lifestyle. And the reason may have a touch of humor to it, because he says, for the time already past is sufficient for you to carry out the desire of the Gentiles. So the reason for the new lifestyle is very simple, is that we have logged adequate time doing our own thing. We have lived our own way long enough. And that is the thought that is involved. We have lived our own way long enough. And I think it would do well for all of us to identify with the verse and say, how long have we been doing our own thing? How long has the central focus of life not been the will of God? And if you would look back in life, I think for most of us we can say, haven't we had enough? Haven't we done this long enough? And that is Peter's argument. You've had plenty of time to carry out the desire of the Gentiles. In other words, your past life is plenty adequate. And then finally, he gives a description of it, and the description of it were all things that were literally public outrage as far as the past life of these people was concerned. Therefore, we have a group of people that had lived, even within the morality of the Roman Empire, had lived outrageous lives, and Peter says that is all to be put in the past. Now, that new lifestyle brings a surprise. And the surprise is on the part of your old friends. They are surprised that all of a sudden you have turned your back on the old lifestyle. So, notice. And in all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them to the same excess of dissipation, and they malign you. So two things come out of this. In the first place, they can't understand a lifestyle that relates something to something other than your own desire. So the surprise is a person who comes along with a lifestyle that relates to something other than self. And that still is a surprise. Basically, this world cannot understand why anybody would want to say the central thing in my life is to please another person, namely Jesus Christ. And that is shocking, and that remains shocking. I think probably if, and we all do, have friends who are not believers and who do not identify with the will of God, if there's anything that you could draw a blank on, is that they cannot understand how in the world you can possibly live a life in the interest of a person that you don't even see and submit everything to him as far as life is concerned when the lifestyle of the average person is within the level of the human. All right, also coming out of that in verse 4 is because they do not understand a person living for someone other than themselves, they come with that with a result. And the result is they malign you, or the result is persecution. So verse 4, the first part is the surprise, and the second part is the maligning or the persecution that comes out of that. So that is the price of the lifestyle. However, when you come down to the completing part of verse 5 and following, you have an emphasis on the price that these two lifestyles will bring. First of all, verse 5. But they, and the word they is in apposition with the word malign, they that malign you shall give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead, living unbelievers, dead unbelievers. For, and now we turn to the believer in verse 6, for the gospel has for this purpose been preached even to those who are dead believers, that though they are judged in the flesh, that is, persecuted by men, they may live in the Spirit according to God. All right, that gives us then a little section about death to the old life centers on the fact of the centrality or the new centrality of the will of God. And now to the positive part, life for the glory of God. Life for God's glory is in 4:7 through 11. Life for God's glory, 1 Peter 4, 7 through 11. And this little section of verses is very simple if you get the key to it. The key to it is how we should live in this life in the light of the fact that everything is transient. So the theme is how to live in a passing world. How to live in a passing world. And that will take these verses and really divide them into two ways. First of all, the statement of fact, verse 7. The end of all things is at hand. Now, the life that should follow, therefore, be of sound judgment, sober spirit for the purpose of prayer, above all, keep fervent, and so forth, down through verse 11. So we really have only two parts that are involved in this, and that is statement of fact, which is in 4:7a. And that statement of fact is very simple. The end of all things is at hand. And second, the word therefore that introduces the life that should follow. So a very simple twofold division of these little cluster of verses that talk about living for the glory of God, and the first is the statement of fact. And let's analyze that now. First of all, when you look at verse 7, we need to focus on the word that Peter makes emphatic. Peter makes two words emphatic, and he does so by putting them right at the beginning of the sentence. And if you were going to guess, what would you guess are the emphatic words? The emphatic words are the two words, all things. That's where the stress is. That's the emphasis. That's where Peter says, I want you to focus. This is what I want you to see. So the end of all things is at hand. Now, what two things are short-lived in the light of Peter's teaching? Peter views two things as very, very short. And the first one is this world order. For an example of that, very emphatically, look at his second letter, 2 Peter 3 and verse 10. Peter views us as living in a world that is ready to go poof anytime. 2 Peter 3 and verse 10, he says, the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works, that's about everything we're surrounded with, the earth and its works will be burned up. Probably one of the most important things we could ever ask about anything we possess is a simple question. Will it burn? And there are many things that we have in life that we're perfectly free to enjoy and we ought to enjoy. But isn't it strange how much effort we put into attaining and financing things that will burn? Nothing in the world wrong with the enjoyment of our homes. God has given them to us, and we ought to enjoy it. But my home, which we work to pay off, will burn. My car, which I enjoy very much, will burn. This building will burn. Clothing will burn. About everything that we're working for will eventually burn. And the perspective of the New Testament authors, and it's a perspective that is very much foreign to thinking today, is you ought to look at life in the light of eternity. And when you look at life in the light of eternity, we spend an awful lot of time in putting our efforts into combustible items that eventually, in 1 Peter 3:10, are going to burn. And this is the perspective that Peter has and the perspective that we ought to likewise have. We also ought to add that shortness is a relative term. A football player, 40 years old, is what? He's ancient. A president of the United States at 40 is extremely young, so it's all a relative matter. And the perspective always of the New Testament authors is to look at everything in the light of eternity. That's always the perspective. And when you look at life in light of eternity, what is life? It is a blip on the screen. How did James, let's take a little time with that. Look at James 4 and verse 14. And see if we can get the perspective of these men. And the thing to note is they always looked at life from the standpoint of eternity. And when you do that, you get an entirely different perspective. And let's face it, we learn to look at life as that's it. You know, that's the whole thing. But in 4:14, look at James' perspective. This is hard to grasp because we're not attuned to this. You do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a poof. It's exactly what he says. You are just a poof that appears for a little while and vanishes away. Now, you know, we like to think about living to a ripe old age. James doesn't know anything about a ripe old age. You know why? He doesn't look at life as 65, 75, 85, 95, 105 years. He is not time-oriented. He is eternity-oriented. And eternity-oriented says, look, it's a vapor. It's like that and it's all over. That is his viewpoint. That is his perspective. Look at Romans 8 for Paul's attitude. Romans 8. Again, emphasizing we do not have this perspective very often. How did Paul look at his present? He looked at it in the light of eternity. I consider, this is verse 18 of chapter 8, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed. Glory to be revealed is saying I'm looking at life in the light of eternity. And that is the way he viewed it. What about Jesus' words? What shall a profit a man if he will gain the whole world and lose his soul? What is he saying? You need to look at your gains in this life in the light of eternity. And that is enormously important. Go back to 1 Peter and notice three places. 1 Peter 1:7. It's a hard perspective because we are now people, aren't we? Everything is now, 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 now. As a matter of fact, we are doing everything we can to allow ourselves to do what we want to now and then cancel the consequences tomorrow, aren't we? That's the whole thrust of things today, and that is totally foreign to the New Testament. Verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice, even though now, get that, now, for a little while. A little while relative to what? Eternity. For a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may give you a soft and easy and comfortable old age. Where do his eyes go? That you may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And that's eternity. And that's the way we're to look at things. Chapter 4, verse 13. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, and that's talking about now, keep on rejoicing. And what motivates you? 10 years from now? 20 years from now? No. So that at the revelation of His glory, that's eternity, you may rejoice with exultation. And chapter 5, verse 10, and after you have suffered for a little, that's in the now, the God of all grace who called you to His, what? Eternal glory in Christ will Himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you, and that is looking to eternity. And therefore, a key idea is we must keep our eyes on eternity and learn to look at life in the light of it. And let's face it, that's hard. That is really hard because isn't everything that is advertised to us spelled with now? And if you do something now that has consequences, we have the medication to cure the consequences tomorrow. So have at it. The present is your privilege to do as you please. And nobody even thinks about the fact that our life compared to eternity is absolutely nothing but a poof. And therefore, we ought to view everything in the light of it. We'll pick up next hour with the second thing that Peter views as part of the all things that are so temporary and so transient. Father, we're thankful today for your word and your truth. May we seek to understand it in order to obey it. In Christ's name, amen.